Tate regime. His books included The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks, and Quitting America, The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land, as well as the book An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. To see all of our interviews, go to democracynow.org with Randall Robinson. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez is moderating an online panel today on Chicago's 2023 mayoral race, reclaiming Harold Washington's multiracial coalition. You can see details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is also currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. To see all of our interview segments, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Hello, lovers of jazz. I am Marcia Hawker, your host for Jazz Lives. On Wednesday, March 29th, I will be joined by Jan Mancuso with research by Paula Walker in honoring the contributions of women in jazz, blues, Latin grooves, and gospel. Voices Without a Voice will cover a woman's place and men's permission. This special four-hour program will air on Wednesday, March 29th, beginning at 12:08 p.m. right here on KBOO 90.7 FM and streaming on KBOO.fm. KBOO.
Good morning. You are listening to More Talk Radio on your community radio station, KBOO FM, 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, and via the World Wide Web, it is KBOO.fm. We are broadcasting on this day, the 27th day in March, 2023. I am Cecil, and I am joined by...
By me, Celeste Carey. Hey, how's it going Monday?
It is great. I took a beautiful picture of the sky as the sun was rising this morning. It's going to be a good day. How are you today?
It's cold, but I was enjoying it. I don't know. Nice Christmas in the air gives sharp detail in some ways to things.
Good way to point it. And sharp detail. So what we're going to talk about this morning is some sharp details.
Absolutely.
And we are pleased that we have with us Carmen Thompson, who is the author of The Making of American Whiteness, The Formation of Race in 17th Century Virginia. Dr. Thompson is an author, a scholar, and as soon as I pull up her bio, I'll share with you.
She is a historian and author of The Making of American Whiteness as you mentioned. Got her PhD in U.S. history from University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Master's of Arts in African American Studies from Columbia University in New York. I like this part right here, is a highly sought expert on race and whiteness in America. Her scholarship has been quoted in the December 2022 Oregon State Supreme Court decision, Watkins Jacob Keith versus Ackley, regarding the disparate racial impact of non-unanimous jury decisions, and wrote the introduction to the book Protest City, Portland's Summer of Rage. And this is a photo book that chronicles all of the protests that occurred after the murder of George Floyd in 2020.
Excellent. And thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Thompson. How are you this morning?
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, the pleasure's ours, believe me.
So, thank you so much for this volume and for your scholarship and for your work. You know, it initially startled me because it seems as if you were determined to turn over, if not sacred, but certainly long-held understanding of race, its origins in the United States, and how we see people and race. Was that your initial intention, or did you always push against the grain?
Well, I mean, it was my intention in the sense that the book started, what started the whole me even going to graduate school in the first place, at least from at my PhD work, the problem that I wanted to understand was, why was it that people of African descent were selected for enslavement by European people, and why in American society European people were ranked highest and black people were ranked lowest, with these categories of black and white. So whiteness is privileged in the United States, and I wanted to know why. And I went to get my doctorate essentially to answer that question. And so when I went to the records and went to the scholarship, you know, I first looked at the 20th. I'm an early American historian, and it wasn't necessarily for my love of that period, but I was drawn there because in answering this question, obviously that question you couldn't answer it in the 20th century. I looked to the 19th century records and documents. There was nothing there about that. So I'm like, you know what, let me just go back to settlement from the time that the European people first crossed the Atlantic and came to Virginia, the first colony, and what is the United States today, first English colony. I wanted to understand from that settlement of Europeans how it is that this notion of whiteness got started. And in looking at that, it made me look at the secondary literature of, you know, preeminent scholars who have all said that, you know, there was no such thing as a white person as we think of it today until the late 17th century, you know, after Bacon's Rebellion in the 1670s. And I'm like, well, that doesn't quite make any sense to me, but okay. And then they said that there were no enslaved people as we think about slavery today with regard to African Americans in 1619 when they arrived. So as I looked at those you know, kind of debates and questions and what seemed to be settled literature, it didn't make sense to me just intellectually by how it was I saw the world. So I went to the records to kind of see what it is that I saw so that I could first just understand, you know, when did this idea of whiteness and white supremacy begin, because I really wanted to understand why it was that they enslaved African people, people of African descent in Virginia, and what then historically was this vitriol against people of African descent, black people in the United States, that lasted from 1619, and we can argue up until the present, but clearly through the civil rights era, when there was just by law and by policy institutionalized racism against people of African descent. And so that is really what I wanted to set out to understand about whiteness and white supremacy. And so my graduate studies work was an attempt to do that.
That's exhaustive work. I'm not just impressed. Yeah. We're trying to narrow down how you would track down these documents, because one of the things we do learn is that history and information have a tendency to be lost, strayed, or stolen, you know. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine how exhaustive that work was, but we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and you know, there is no smoking gun in the records that say I hate black people. So
right.
You know, that's not there. But the documents that I looked at are not hidden. I didn't find I found it. There was nothing like that. The documents that I looked at that I cite in the book are just everyday documents, many of them quoted in all of the secondary literature I looked at. But what I was looking at was the actions of the European people, what they said and what they did. And that then, I argue, really is an expression of their whiteness.
You are listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 if you're in the Columbia River Gorge. In the Willamette River Valley, it is 104.3 everywhere, KBOO.FM. This is More Talk Radio. We're here today with Dr. Carmen Thompson, and we're discussing her book, The Making of American Whiteness, The Formation of Race in the 17th Century. Virginia. So one of the key things I think might be helpful for establish is, what is this concept, or this, I don't want to call it commodity, but it clearly was a sought after thing or status, you know. But what is whiteness? And how, you know, let's unpack that first.
Yeah, whiteness is an expectation of privilege and advantage from the government and society for white people. And it sometimes is explicit, oftentimes it's implicit, but it is this expectation of privilege and advantage. When European people came over here, they came over here with an expectation. And that expectation was to have a better life for themselves initially, and then obviously it was to have land, Native American land, and the resources that came out of it, to have more wealth than what they had in England. And then they used people of African descent from 1619 when they arrived to advance that cause, and obviously Native American land, and then fights amongst themselves between the classes of Europeans to be able to establish within law and policy and society distinctive advantages for them.
So I'm trying to set this up, and so Cecil, jump in and help me. So the expectation of an improvement of life, not just for themselves, but for their family and their social networks moving forward, was the expectation. And it sounds like whiteness was a tool. But I guess the next question would be, did whiteness play as an important role back in these European areas that they were leaving, as it was going to play in the New World?
Not in particular, because they came over with the idea of having a better quality of life. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have that life where they were. So they were coming over for a type of utopia, in the same way, you know, people left other parts, say, in the United States. You think of people coming to Oregon for this better life. So when you leave out, you know, to a certain place, you obviously are coming for a certain reason. You have this expectation. And so they came here for a specific purpose, for a better life. And once they got here, through the Native American lands, they began setting up a system through land and through resources, and utilizing not only Native American lands and people, but then people of African descent. They began setting up laws and policies within society that would instill their advantage in a lot of ways and in a lot of sectors in society. So they set up laws, for example, to not trade with Native American people. They brought over lots of European people. As they were bringing them over, they were giving land to those who invested into the setting up of the colony of Virginia. They gave them lots of Native American land and just gave that to them because they invested in just the whole program of coming over and just setting it up. And then you had those European people who could not afford to come on their own. They were sponsored by the wealthier people, or they came over to live with family and friends and then volunteered their labor as European indentured servants so that they then could have privileges and advantages later. So they sold their labor for a set period of time, and that was fixed into law, 7 years, 14 years, and there was laws and contracts and indentured servant is there's a contract laborer for a set period of time. And so they set, and those were European people. And so in 1607, when Europeans settled here, before people of African descent arrived as enslaved, captured people from the continent of Africa on European slave ships, it was basically European people and Native Americans. And so Europeans then were setting up their society, you know, battling with Native American people for land. And so part of the ways in which they did that is that they needed the European indentured servants to set up the land, to set up the society in the way that they needed. So they had to have a certain number of laborers to do that. So European people who couldn't afford to come over and on their own, and to have Native and to, you know, kind of purchase or finance the program of colonization of the New World, they couldn't. They had to then sell their labor, and in doing that, and selling their labor, they were able to sell it for a certain period of time and then get rights later on in society that guaranteed them, obviously, citizenship and how it was that they were going to be treated, certain freedoms, and particularly that they would never be enslaved. So when the whole New World Society was started initially, it was always contemplated that it was a land for European people, even those who were indentured servants. They never could be enslaved. They always were considered to be free. They always had automatic citizenship and freedoms and belongings. And as soon as their indentured servitude was up, they were usually given land and given a stipend of money called freedom dues that they would give them so they can set up land and then maybe have their own indentured servants. And then when enslaved Africans arrived,
let's put a pause on that.
Okay,
because it's dense,
but it is a lot.
but also, and I want you to expand a little bit around indentured servants.
Yes,
and in terms of going against again the popular idea. And I suppose your book probably won't be used in schools in Florida because some people might be upset. But
right.
But a popular understanding or myth is that when these first people from Africa arrived, they were also indentured servants, and that their status was no different than white indentured servants. But as you do so well in your book. You not only we not only hear of the stories and voices of Europeans, but of those who are often not heard. So we have stories such as John Punch, and the stories such as Elizabeth Key, people of African descent who might have been thought of as being indentured servants and somewhat equal to others, but
right.
that isn't the case in terms of understanding of the role and the status of those from Africa as opposed to those from Europe. And I think you prove your point very well in terms of saying that from the initial encounter, there was something different about the status of Africans from European indentured servants.
Yes, I mean, so it's absolutely false to think that African people were treated and were the same status as European indentured servants. And that's one of the things that I had to argue against as far as the standing literature, because even today, historians, most the canon in the literature suggests that African people were not slaves as we know it today. Now, they didn't call them that, but when they arrived enslaved and captured. And the only way that they could become free once they landed in Virginia in 1619 as captured and enslaved on European slave ships was to either purchase their freedom, and oftentimes they would do that selling cattle or crops that they had grew on their own, or that their owner would manumit them, meaning that they would free them. Whereas European indentured servants, they were on a contract. They were on a labor contract for 7 years, 5 years, or 14 years. It was various types of contract lengths, but their whole status was defined by law. Their term of service was defined by law. Their treatment would be defined by law. And it was guaranteed that once they were done, they were free to go on and live their lives. And in fact, as I said, they were given what I call freedom dues and often land after they went. And plus, when they came, European indentured servants, it was voluntary. They voluntarily came, voluntarily sold their labor, you know, entered into that contract with the individual owner, European owner, or the government to work. So this was all voluntary, knowing that they would be part of the society and free at some point. African people, their status was undefined, but it was taken that they were not to be incorporated into society and not to be free, because when they then came over, the only way that they could be free was to buy their freedom or be manumitted. Now, I don't know what you call a slave, but if the only way that I can be free is to purchase my freedom or have the owner manumit me, that's a slave by any other name. So the fact that they didn't call it that is why historians and maybe the history books will not call them slave in the way that you and I and people kind of think about it today. But they were enslaved. And then on top of that, if they had children while they were in this quote-unquote indefinite form of bondage that I call slavery in my book, if they had children while they were during that time, when they became free, their children had to stay. Okay, so I had a child, and can think about those early Africans in 1619. If they had a child, they became free for some good fortune of purchasing their freedom or being manumitted, then their child had to stay. Well, that makes you your child a slave too. In the same way, European women, if they had a slave while they were an indentured servant, their child came with them. And so that right there sets up this distinction in day-to-day life about the distinctions around freedom that labor and servitude distinguished between African and European people that were in the New World. So that right there is a critical distinction in the day-to-day lives of the citizens, that everyone understood that there was a distinction. In the same way that you and I today, we live around and we go around in our daily life, we may interact and work alongside European people, white people, but we still know in our day-to-day lives that there is a distinction, and that plays out on the area of race. I argue in my book that this idea of the European indentured servant, and then obviously the other Europeans who weren't free, and how the European indentured servants were treated relative to African people and how they were treated in servitude, is a shining example of whiteness and this distinction in day-to-day life that established these racial distinctions that I argue point to American whiteness.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO FM, with Cecil and Celeste. Our guest this morning is Dr. Carmen Thompson, author of The Making of American Whiteness, The Formation of Race in 17th Century Virginia.
17th Century Virginia, yes. You can join in our conversation. The phone number is 503-231-8187. So, Dr. Thompson, this is a perfect time to kind of segue and explain a little bit more in detail how the early whites who came to this country, or to this land mass, because it wasn't a country at this time, at that time, some of the distinctions that maybe are not taught, and we don't learn about some of the finer distinctions of white servitude and indentureship here in this country. And in chapter two of your book, you title it, and I love this title, Duty Boys, Company Tenants, Slave-Holding Ladies, and Wealthy Planters. And you kind of touched on it a little bit when you talked about different aspects of servitude and contractual basis. So can you kind of expand on that a little bit more?
Sure. So within white society, there was this intra-class dynamic. And so you had set up, obviously, the wealthier people who could afford to come over and set up the land and have, they were given, like the early Europeans that came, depending on how much money they invested in the colonization project of Virginia, the colonial government granted these people certain number of hundreds of acres of land. So depending upon how much you invested, you got so many hundreds of acres of land. And so that was one class of people. And those class of Europeans, they were part of the colonial government. They were the part of the colonial gentry, if you will. And they would be, like today, like the wealthy, you know, upper middle class, millionaire type class. And then you had other people who maybe didn't have that much land. They were kind of middling kind of people, and maybe they only were given 50 acres of land, again, because of their level of investment. So they were investors in this Virginia Company of London. So they had this, they organized, when they decided to colonize Virginia, they organized this business venture and then this company, this investment company, this stock-owning company called the Virginia Company of London. And these Europeans who were wealthy would purchase stock in that company towards the goal of colonizing Virginia. And those who purchased that stock, the more stock that you had, then that would translate into more land when you arrived. And so that set up, you know, the upper class of society, if you will. And those who maybe didn't have as much money or didn't to invest in stock, or just could come over on their own but really didn't own any stock, were either given very little land, or, you know, just kind of had, few acres of land, but they could still kind of afford to take care of themselves. Then you had those who had no money, and the European people that couldn't buy stock at all and that were essentially poor over in England. And oftentimes how they would get over, they would voluntarily come over. And not only through family and friends of those who were wealthier, but the government, the colonial government, sponsored this program called the Sandys Program, and then they then advertised to these poor men in England to come on over, and if you work for a certain period of time, which they called duty boys and company tenants, and they were different. Those were ranked kind of programs that they had, but they were essentially employment programs. They would say, you know, come on over. If you come over here, you know, you get after a certain number of years, you'll get so much land. You know, just come and work, come and volunteer, come and help us out. You know, and you will have, you know, the owner of land and potential, you know, rise to whatever level that you want to be at in society. So many of the poor men kind of came on over under this government program. And again, it was voluntarily, they volunteered to do it. They sold their labor for a certain period of time. The company tenants, it was 7 years, and the duty boys, it was 14. Oftentimes these people were treated bad. That's why you always hear these terms of, you know, these slave, you know, European slaves and European indentured servants, like they were slaves too, but they weren't. They were under contract, and there were laws, and there were rules, and there were regulations as to how that they could be treated. So then that set up that class, and then you had these women, these white women, that even when they were indentured servants, they were trained on the domestic sphere to be wives to, you know, either the company tenants or duty boys, or even higher up if they could marry someone like that. So they didn't work in the fields as much. They were basically being trained in the homes of the wealthier white women to be the wealthier people by the wealthier men's wives to be the wives of these, you know, men who were coming over. So they would be trained in the domestic sphere, and they were considered dependents. Those women then would, you know, the slaveholding ladies, I call them, they would train the European indentured servant women to come on over, and when they came, to be the wives and the mothers. And again, as they still had the same contract as the men, the 7 years or 14 years servitude that they would have. And again, as I said, if they had children while they were in servitude, their children then would go with them when they got out of their contract. So, you know, you have this kind of system within European society, within the European classes of various ranks. And where some of the discord happens that we can talk about that I think is relevant even in today's society is that oftentimes those lower class people, they were expecting to have the land as the wealthier stock investors had, that they were hoping to be able to have this, but people being people, the wealthier Europeans were being greedy and they wanted to keep it all from themselves. And so that created a lot of distrust and dysfunction within the class of Europeans, and which led to Bacon's Rebellion kind of a little later in the 1670s. Mm-hmm. And what that did is part of that rebellion when European men basically and some Native Americans and even a few Africans were kind of battling together against kind of their colonial government. Really, it was European people, European men, that were mad that they weren't getting the Native American land like the wealthier men. And so they fought and said, hey, I'm not going to, you know, support you if you don't acquiesce. And so one of the acquiescence, the things that the government, the colonial government and the gentry acquiesced to, was allowing those men to be able to have the right to vote. And so prior to Bacon's Rebellion, the only people who could vote is those who owned land. So you can see the importance of those stock investors setting up, early stock investors of the Virginia Company and the colonization of Virginia, to be able to have, they had all that land, so they had all the control and they can vote. And then the male European indentured servants initially could not vote until, you know, they got land. Well, they didn't get by law, the ability to vote until after Bacon's Rebellion in 1776. So I know I'm saying a lot, but, you know, this is a lot to kind of go through, and so I'm just trying to string it all together. So feel free to jump in and direct me as you see fit. But just kind of wanted to lay that out and thinking about the European class structure and kind of the intra-racial class dynamic within Virginia society that really kind of expands the expectation. This is where you see this expectation kind of being reified and the tensions within white racial society.
Exactly.
And you see that then, I would argue, even in modern day society, when you see these backlashes that have happened over time, say in Reconstruction, with the formation of the Ku Klux Klan, when you had
Jump up to now, the Proud Boys.
Right. When you see Proud Boys, you see, you know, MAGA people. All of that is this white backlash. It's not so much against black people. This is intra-racial white people saying,
right,
hey, you're not giving me what I'm expecting.
What was promised
society,
to me.
What was promised. These
right.
other groups are advancing. These are, so as African people and other minorities within American society seem to be gaining more rights because of all kinds of things with industrialization and business, global business ventures that are making, you know, job opportunities and things less for regular everyday white people like it used to be when they would cut African-American people and other groups of people out of the jobs, say, within the plants and factories and society that they just automatically had jobs given to, just like here in Oregon, where down with the on the shores, I mean, on the in Vanport and in those areas in the shipping, they were given the major jobs and black people couldn't get into the unions and their kids couldn't do all that. When those things start drying up or when changes start happening and other groups just start making even a little bit of traction, you see then everyday white folks getting mad. That type of backlash that you see at various points of society as other groups and other racialized groups advance, I argue is what Bacon's Rebellion kind of, prefigured.
Yes.
So one thing that your book argue, as you just said, is give us a longer view of understanding class and racial dynamics in this country, so that early on, as you hinted at, these stratification, class stratification, and racial stratification that occurs in our society, and we could point to today, we could point to what happened in the 60s, Reconstruction, and going back. But what I think your book does very well is that it backdates these type of tensions before the Bacon's Rebellion, and at least, you know, people were saying, and you can change the language just a little bit these days, but at least, you know, I may be a company tenant and a duty boy, but I'm not an African. And those type of class and racial differences that was played upon by those in power continue to manifest itself in different ways today.
Yes, they do. And I mean, so yes, you're right. One of my major interventions is really, like you said, backdating and dating whiteness and white supremacy and really the enslavement of black people, you know, dating whiteness back to the settlement, 1607, and saying that black people were, in fact, enslaved as we think about it today, although not using that name, in 1619. And by showing that, then the question becomes then, what kind of society is the United States as we think of it today? You know, if this is how the system was a white supremacist society at settlement, which all of our history books argue against, the little narrative that we've grown up with in our American society, this kind of lullaby that we have, that we tell ourselves about what it means to be American and what this society is. If we were white supremacists at European settlement, if African people were enslaved, and of course we can always talk about Native Americans as well as far as how they were treated. If that's who we were from the very beginning, I argue, and none of our books really argue the dating that I have, the chronology, mm-hmm. then what does that say then about our society and who we are, and then about, you know, whiteness and being white in America? And I think that's what makes people be uncomfortable. And what I'm arguing is that and one of the things that I suggest is that we, you know, do not have to accept this. What I'm trying to say is this is the system under which we founded, and these types of systems and the benefits and the expectations are just kind of implied in our ingrained and institutionalized and systematized within our system in such a way that oftentimes people don't know that not only that that this is an organized system that was set up, but that is one that they kind of live by and kind of go by and don't even recognize, like, you know, fish doesn't know it's in water. This is the same system that we live in. And when I'm and a lot of times people, you know, kind of, you know, push back against yes. that. But it's the same way when I'm teaching classes, the same way as like if someone's having a baby and you say, well, I'm going to go buy something for the baby shower. Oh, is it a boy or a girl? What do? You go buy the matching color based upon their gender without even thinking about it. In fact, I defy anyone to go find, you know, anything other than pink or blue within the baby section. We don't even think about it. Someone has told us that blue means boy and the pink means girl. And we don't think about it. We don't question it. It's all in the stores. And even if we may know it intellectually, we still just kind of follow into it. In the same way, when the society that you enter into is set up from its founding, from its before the founding, from the time that European people came to what is the place that what is part of what is the United States, had a system established for their benefit, then that is part of the water in which we're in. And I want people to know that if you know that and see that and understand that, then perhaps we can do something about it to make it better.
Well, how then, especially in these times, and you're certainly well aware of the resentment and the pushback that this type of scholarship is getting throughout this nation. How do we acknowledge the systemic racism when there is so much, not only in institutions such as, you know, education institutions, government institutions, which say, no, the idea of systemic racism on whiteness as a concept should not be taught, and that it is wrong. How do you people in your field push back against that sense of resentment and resistance to this concept?
Well, first of all, people have to just detach it from them personally, because people just kind of take personal offense. And what I think and believe, and I think my scholarship shows, is that because it's a system, that doesn't mean it's you. So you don't have to adopt it personally. You can see what the system is and try to work against that. And all kinds of people are doing that. There's all kind of anti-racist groups around here. I know of several. I'm sure many of your listeners do. And so you can rebel against that system in the same way we rebel against other systems, or, you know, push back against and do not adopt various other systems that are in our society, that govern our society around a variety of issues. I mean, people don't you know, say, hey, you know, we're on a path of, you know, climate change in a way that we don't like. And so I see, you know, how that started and how that came with industrialization and how that's part of our, you know, modern day society with cell phones and all the ways in which we live our lives and, you know, cheap clothing and all of this kind of stuff from various places. We can see, you know, how this has impacted our lives and how the modern society has impacts the world and the environment, and people rebel against that because they understand the system that set it up. In the same way, I'm arguing that, and I suggest that you can do that by understanding the racial system that was set up to advantage and privilege certain people. And obviously, we live in a capitalist society, and by definition, that means inequality. And race and gender and all these other sorts of things are the ways in which, you know, the society is kind of setting its citizens up against one another to advance, you know, really the causes of the extremely wealthy people. So, you know, we just have to just understand, you know, the world in which we live in, and that is difficult to accept for a lot of people, but, you know, I'm hoping that my book and kind of pointing this out will detach the personalization of, you know, this feeling and realize that these ideas about race and whiteness and how we've had this system set up, this is set up for a divisive purpose. And this is set up to divide, because as long as you have these racial categories and the advantages in economics built within them as well as other things, then that in and of itself, if we buy into that, then we're effectively reifying the system. And so we just, I think by systematizing it and showing to the degree that it is built within our institutions, I think that that points to a way out of it and detaching it from our personal selves and looking at it more from a social, you know, establishment and organization.
The social construct that it is. Yeah.
Yes.
So I have a question here, because there, we don't have enough time to unpack this properly, yes. But in trying to rebel and push back, as you mentioned, it opens up another discussion, and that is self-identification, or, you know, being identified. So one of the things that's really fascinating about the Proud Boys is that you find a lot of Latino men involved. And I was talking with a friend of mine who is Mexican to help me understand, actually a couple of my friends, you know, from his perspective, even though, you know, that is not a homogenous community, because you have Spanish people speaking people from all around the world, from different cultures. Right. But I found it really interesting that here in the United States, you had a large percentage of leaders that were Latino. And I asked him, he says, well, it's this whole concept of who I am, and I'm not Black. And so that kind of, you know, by default, that means I'm white. And there's like this real anxious and angry grasping at this whole thing that I mentioned in the beginning, like this title or this conferred status of whiteness. So if you push back on it, what happens to whiteness? Because for some people, that whole concept is not necessarily a political or socioeconomic identity, it is a racial identity. So I can see how people would really fight against pushing back on the privilege and status of whiteness, because they see it as being erased or replaced. Does that make sense?
There's a lot of power and advantage that come with that, and it is difficult for people to grasp and to accept. And you do see people of other races, you know, participating in these, you know, types of organizations. And somehow people think that because of that, then that doesn't mean it's racist. But you've always had black people, you know, participating in systems and institutions that have hurt other black people. So that doesn't mean in and of itself that our society isn't white supremacist and that this whiteness isn't an identity. But that is really the power of this racial system that we have, is that because it's set around kind of economic benefits, then what, you know, scholars and my, you know, advisors and people when I was in graduate school, David Roediger, calls the wages of whiteness. There's this psychological wage of privilege and advantage that, like you said, at least I'm not black, because we have a society, you know, kind of a structure where, you know, you have whites on top and blacks on the bottom and all the other racial groups in between. And instead of working together, again, you know, as people basically of the middle and working class, kind of working together as groups across racial lines, oftentimes, you know, we are pitted against one another. And it is my hope that if we see that we have these common interests, you know, working together, then we can rail against, you know, what you see people in Florida and Trump and DeSantis and all these other people are doing, because that's why they continue to utilize, you know, that dog whistle of race to the poor and working class whites, because, you know, there's not enough of wealthier whites that think like Trump and DeSantis to keep them elected. They need kind of the poor and working class whites who believe into this dog whistle and just out and out racist ideas about race, and that they will get some advantages. They need, you know, that group of people, regular working class whites, to kind of buy into that so they continue to vote and kind of keep them in power and office and keep them relevant. Without that, then those groups, the higher up whites, the DeSantis's and the racist people who really espouse these types of ideas, would just go away. But that, and so, you know, you can't, you know, you're always going to see that happening in society. And like I said, by pointing that out to people, I think that is the first step in just kind of seeing that this is a system that, you know, all of us are being played in a lot of ways, and we just have to, you know, turn against that and envision another type of society in which we're not going against, you know, one another, but are working together. And I think that's part of what the Obama coalition was trying to do. When you bring racial groups together, when you bring people together, there is hope. But if you notice that any time in our society where you see someone like King and others, Kennedy, when you're bringing groups of people together across racial lines, you know, those people get assassinated, they get attacked, the government goes against them.
Well, let me jump in here for a moment and change the dynamic here. We got a caller, John, and I do want to make sure we get him on the air here, Dr. Thompson. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. I got into the show late, so I'm sure I missed some good stuff. I've called in and recommended books, and here's another recommendation.
Well, actually interviewing an author about her book, so I really want to focus on that.
Okay, anyway, sorry about that. I didn't realize that. This book is called The Warmth of Other Suns.
Okay, I understand that, John, but I would, just out of respect for our guest, could you refer to her book instead?
All right, well, I'm sorry. I just jumped in on the phone. And
oh, okay. Well, thank you for your call, nonetheless.
All right. Anyway.
And we're speaking with Dr. Carmen Thompson. And as Celeste mentioned, that, you know, we only have her for a short time, but you have an opportunity to engage with her in a longer conversation on April 20th at 1 p.m. as part of the Black Bag Speakers series at Portland State University at 1 p.m. There will be a reading, signing, and discussion with Dr. Thompson. So if you're able to, attend that event.
One other thing, though, that I also wanted to point out is, as you mentioned, Cecil, about the ways in which people of African descent were rebelling against whiteness. So these categories of white and black weren't totally defined, as we say, but they were practiced. Mm-hmm. And so people of African descent were quickly learning that and how those rules were being set up against them, and utilized the law to try to make themselves more free. So you had mentioned that Elizabeth Key, and she's an important woman. She sued for her freedom in 1654. Her mother was an enslaved African. Her father was a European indentured servant. At the time, they had a policy that said that if you were Christian, you couldn't be enslaved. Christian was in code for white. And then, obviously, if your father was European, from a paternity standpoint, that means that you should be free. And so because she was enslaved as a person of African descent and had the parentage that she did and the religious affiliation she did, she argued that she should be free, and she won. Again, these things weren't codified in law in the way we think about them today. But then shortly after that case, though, they changed.
That loophole was closed. Right.
Well, you know, the goalpost.
Yes. Well, you know, that's an important distinction. And that goes to, again, and it was coincidental that in the very end of Democracy Now! You had a conversation about being identified as Negro. You know, mm-hmm. as opposed to your country of origin, for example. And it wasn't just being identified as savage or non-Christian,
right.
You know, which were code language is for fair game to be enslaved, but your selfhood, your personhood was taken away. And that's something that didn't happen to indentured people. You retained your personhood because you could enter into a contract. So you had a legal status. Whereas the difference with the Africans who were enslaved is they became property.
Yeah,
And you could not argue that, well, property is not sentient in that state, and, you know, because it didn't work. If it really had worked, then none of Thomas Jefferson's children would have been enslaved with
exactly.
Sally Hemings. And
exactly.
that was the difference. You became property, chattel slavery. And yes, we had slavery in other countries all around the world, but it wasn't always practiced as chattel slavery. And I think that's an important distinction that people miss.
And you talk about that in your book a little bit about how servanthood was practiced in African cultures.
Yes. Yeah, they've always had levels of unfreeness within the continent of Africa. And oftentimes you hear people say, black people sold other black people, you know. And, you know, but they don't understand that in Africa, everybody's black. So we're thinking with the lens of race like we have here in the United States, and then, you know, superimposing it on Africa. So when you have a society where everybody is black, race is not the issue like what we think about it here. They have other ways in which of distinguishing people. And so they had degrees of freedom within African cultures and within communities there. But they never were chattel in the same way as they were here. And they always would, you know, retain, you know, their personhood, their dignity. They could marry. Their children would be free. I mean, all the things that we think about in the United States, slavery was not on the continent of Africa, pre-European contact. But I would say, too, to Celeste's point about the use of the term Negro, as I point out in my book, they were calling Africans Negroes from 1619, and then we can argue into the 80s, I guess, when black people decided, you know, that we would not utilize that term. So that's a term when John Rolfe said, hey, there's nothing on this ship but 20 and odd Negroes. Every time in the record when somebody of African descent from 1619, and again, we can say into the 1980s, anytime somebody from African descent in the early 17th century was identified, it always had Negro before their name. They never were just, you know, John Smith like the European indentured servants. They had their first name and their last name. Negro was always a part of the description of a person of African descent, but it never was for somebody of European descent, as far as how what they would call them. They didn't call them anything but their by their first and last name. So right there, you see a racialized distinction from the very beginning that I argue points to whiteness and anti-blackness in a way to distinguish the status and distinction between those two groups of people in society.
We have a caller, Francis. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I just tuned in, so I missed most of the conversation. But I don't even know if this is relevant, but I would like to know if your guest, how does Benjamin Banneker and his grandmother, how does their story fit into this context?
Well, I mean, in the sense that, you know, they had rules and regulations about, you know, how they could live and be in the world, how it is that, yes, Benjamin Banneker went on for these great inventions, but who knows where he would have been but for these racialized distinctions and but for slavery. He would have been thought of, Benjamin Franklin and some of these great inventors of our society, instead kind of relegated to the, you know, Black History Month and talking about them that way. He's not prominent in our school books and revered in our books the way in which these other figures and inventors are.
Yeah, and I've heard different stories about his grandmother. Was she at first an indentured servant?
She was enslaved. If she was Black and in bondage, it was slavery. And well, all Black people weren't enslaved. Yeah, I don't know about his grandmother, but if she was of African descent and
she was not.
I'm not sure what her status was, but if she was Irish and she was an indentured servant, as I was saying, she had different rules and regulations about her servitude than Benjamin Banneker's family or descendants of his family. So, you know, there was this social distinction and lived distinction between the races.
Well, thank you, Francis.
We got to go. Thank you for your call. So just once again, Cecil, where can people meet and talk with Dr. Thompson and about a book?
Dr. Thompson, you can tell us. It's on April 20th at PSU.
Yeah, first there'll be a talk and signing at the Oregon Historical Society on April 6th at 5:30, so the downtown Oregon Historical Society, April 6th. I'll be speaking and signing books. I'll be in conversation on April 6th at the Oregon Historical Society with Dr. Daryl Milner of PSU. Many of you know him.
Oh, yes, I know.
Yes, so he's great, so I'm honored to be in conversation with him on
April 6th. It'll be a great time for sure.
Yes, and then on the April 20th at PSU at 1 p.m. During their Black Bag series, and sponsored by the Black Studies Department at PSU.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Thompson, for a wonderful, exciting hour of conversation. And people do attend if you can. Thank you to our engineer, Ray. And thank you all who support KBOO for keeping us your community connection. KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting